woke up this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
Found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Out. Rick Pappas on the board. We have S&P futures up a bunch here. We have them up exact number as soon as I can. I think we're up like 95 points. Well, kind of that's a lot. We have the Dow up 400, and we have the NASDAQ is up, they're looking at copper and gold. NASDAQ's up 414. So we're talking about a huge move here today, percent to 2%. We were up yesterday pretty big after the announcement and actually turned negative a little bit, not much. We were down, more than a little bit. Dow was down 103. It was up 500. S&P was down 16. It was up pretty huge. NASDAQ got down 54. Gold at a 60-point turnaround after the announcement, which is a real number. What'd you think of that one, Greg? 16 points in the gold and silver did the same thing. I mean, all of a sudden people were very unsettled with the evidently a news conference or something, and then all of a sudden here we are.
Par for the course.
Yeah, it's par for the
people pushing the market around.
Well, that's kind of. Do we have Professor Liu?
Yeah, I think.
Don't worry, buddy.
When Israel invades Lebanon, you'll see another big jump in gold, so I wouldn't react too much on one day's turn. Isn't that what you always tell me?
Yeah, well, it's when you see turns like that, the markets are thin and they're not designed the way they used to be. As soon as something turns, everybody just gets out of the way. The people who make the markets also, in a lot of ways, get to see the orders coming, so they get a chance to pull their offers or their bids.
The real question is, what's Bitcoin doing?
It's way up. Yeah, it's way up. It's got it up 62,353. So I mean, what we've seen.
What is Bitcoin? What is Bitcoin seen as a measure of? Is it if when it goes up, is it seen as a measure of instability or is
irrational
it
exuberance?
Irrational
exuberance.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's an artificial stock, Lou. Might as well. What's the difference between artificial stock and a company that's not worth much? Really, I mean, You know, it's to me, Greg will probably disagree, maybe not. It's absolutely the Fed going back to the business as usual of the last 25 years, which is steadily leak money into the system, decrease the value of your currency because you owe a bunch of money. Asset holders.
Did I tell you guys my theory of Bitcoin?
No.
It's kind of like what you just said, just like, you know, company or whatever. Yeah, my price target is about $150,000.
Well, I mean,
just simply because it puts it that then it's, you know, around the same size as Microsoft or whatever, and it's just another.
Except Microsoft actually is a company.
Well, Bitcoin's actually a company.
Well, how do you figure that? You don't. You get nothing
from
them.
There's a lot of transactions that happen.
They don't get paid by them for them. You don't own stock in it.
That's not about. Yeah, it's not. That's not about that one. It's about the. Is it useful or not? So, the dollar you don't get anything, but it's going bananas.
Lake Michigan's useful. I don't have to pay for that.
Good luck.
Yeah,
we will soon.
Lou, it's tulips without the tulip. But that's just me.
Tulips aren't good for money launderers.
All right. I don't want to go down this road because I have other stuff to talk to with Lou. But We're talking about whether something is a way to transmit wealth back and forth. It seems to be able to do that, but if it's a currency, is also supposed to be a something that stores value. The currency doesn't trade every day like that. Oh no, this week it's worth $60,000. No, it's really worth $20,000. Your variability in your currency, if it is a currency, is bizarre. And all currencies, in currency theory, is all currencies eventually reach the point where they have their regular value. Regular value meaning they're worth gold or worth something. Now, fiat currencies have gone further than that and are obviously not worth $35 an ounce in gold like the U.S. dollar used to be, but there's still something there. We have aircraft carriers, we have bridges, we have stuff. Now, are there too many dollars out there? You know you're not going to get me to fight you on that one. Yeah, and that's exactly what the Fed has said they're doing. They're going right back to this relentless debase the currency. People think the market's up.
They have to.
They have to what?
They have to.
They don't have to.
How else are you going to pay off that much debt?
Well, you could do what you're supposed to do.
No.
Well, the thing of it is we have a history of this. People have been around for like a really long
years.
No. What are you talking about? This, the tulips from the 1600s, same thing.
Fiat currency?
We have any time. Rome. Lula knows a lot about Rome. The
so that was like, what, 500 years?
People don't change.
I think about Rome every day.
Yeah. Well,
right? You think about the Roman Empire every day.
But this currency debasement has been a trick since day one, and it's never worked. Rome had what was it, Lou? The amount of silver in a, was it the denarius? Was that the name of the currency?
I mean, we've got an iPhone.
Yes.
What's that got to do with anything?
It worked.
Okay, but I'm saying their currency was enough silver in there, essentially in one denarius was in a day's pay, right, Lou? And as time went by, less and less and less, and all of a sudden you started paying people in the provinces and borrowing money. They're fighting your wars for you. They're doing all your stuff. And one of these days, and Rome went under after a long time, but they were disgustingly screwed up for, 200 years before they went under, Lou? And they weren't Rome at all.
Yeah, well, okay. So, you know, depending on your count, I mean, Rome gets sacked in the first time. I mean, it got sacked in waves. I think the first time was sometime in the 5th century. So they were doing okay up until about, I would say, the middle 300s.
But okay was not everything balanced, everybody having a job, those kinds of things, like a couple hundred years before.
Well, no, the rot took a long time. But yeah, that's the whole bread and circuses, culture that developed around the 4th century.
If you want to read history, because I mean, I honestly believe, I mean, I'm not a scholar on ancient writings, but I did take a couple of classes in Greek tragedy. Little people don't change, do they? Same thing. Somebody screw around with his mother. Somebody screw around with this. By the way, I have a bumper sticker for you. You know, I'm going off the rails here, but that's okay. Lou, do you ever see something and then you immediately? I know you have the same. Even though a lot of times we don't agree on much, we have almost the exact same mental curiosity about things. When like you see a disgusting, like bright lime green car or something, it's not just it. It's wait a minute. Who the hell painted that thing? Who ordered it? How did it get on somebody's lot? Was there a discount? And did the guy get a discount for buying it? Or did he order it? You just think of all the things that had to happen for the car to be sitting next to you on the street. Well, yesterday I'm driving along 159th Street. And I see, well, to use the term bumper sticker anymore, nobody's got a bumper, right? So actually the sticker is plastered on, I assume it was this lady's rear door of her, whatever, the door that comes up like the little SUV.
Hatchback.
Yeah. Guess what the sticker says?
I have absolutely no idea.
If you're going to ride my ass, you could at least grab my hair.
Okay.
And I'm sitting there, the show title?
I'm sitting there going, wait a minute. Who would print that? Who would stock it at a store? And who the hell would buy it?
Well, and somebody more importantly, somebody thought, this is really funny.
Yeah,
I'm gonna put it on my car,
and you know when you put a sticker on like the paint, I don't think it's easy to come off, is it? I don't know how you'd get it off without having to sand it off. I mean, maybe there's some solvent or something. It won't take the paint off; it'll take that off. But Aren't those things pretty permanent once you stick them on your paint?
I wouldn't put it on paint.
Is this person attractive?
I just
that's the question.
They were in front of me. I couldn't really tell if it was a guy or a girl.
I'm asking what the listeners want to hear.
Oh, I know.
Right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So my all-time favorite bumper sticker, one that caused me to burst out loud laughing and almost lose control of my car, was decades ago. I think in the 1980s, and it was a bumper sticker that says "Jesus saves, but Esposito scores on the rebound."
God. Well, you know, and
that remains my favorite.
Well, you know, that happens. I mean, I don't know how when the Fed was putting this all this stuff together for a long period of time, they had every other central bank was in the same game, and now that it's created all this inflation, which the Fed, that guy can talk for 2 weeks, and I'll tell you what, he has no more business of fighting inflation than the man in the moon. It's on you, buddy. If you can't find a way to make him off money to deal with it, it's on you. I mean, they're not. He has no more intention of fighting inflation. Never did than the man in the moon. One man's opinion. Anyway, but now the rest of the world is not going along with him. The Bank of England kept their rates steady last night. So, if we're not in this together, where everybody screws their citizens worldwide in unison, I think we're going to have a problem. More problems than we have, and you know I'm really surprised that the press, the economic press, listen to his news conference yesterday and the softball questions people were lobbing at him. Now this morning, I must have listened three times on News Radio 78 and last night on the way home, that this is so good for everybody because your credit card rates are coming down. Greg, what are the chances of that? A snowball in hell?
You know, I'm kind of disappointed. I'm trying to put this bumper sticker in our show notes, and it's saying we're unable to load the preview.
God. Anyway, that's probably good. But, I mean, this policy is just, other than taking money from most people and giving it to other people, it's just flawed. It is just flawed, and I can't believe it's happening in my lifetime after seeing it happen when I was young.
I mean, you're not going to get any arguments from me on this. The more I look at our spending patterns, and the more I look at just, you know, focusing on sort of the business of government, it looks like a gigantic. I'm just looking at it here in locally in Colorado is where I can actually see it in a granular way that I understand. But a huge percentage of our discretionary spending simply looks like distributing money to favored people,
without a doubt,
and that's all. That's all it is. It's not aimed at doing anything other than pork barreling, at every level. And one of the really interesting things that has come out of this whole Haitian immigration issue in Springfield is some granularity and detail about how much money is being given to them, that mayor and his organization, his housing entities, that's being distributed through NGOs, and just, you know, effectively rewarding people for basically doing not very much except knowing other people in the government. It's really interesting.
Well, when you drop down to the contract is so good that I don't even have to do it. I can subcontract it out because somebody else is willing to do it for 80%.
Yep.
And I don't. When you get to that level, I think it's heinous. I don't think
this is America, guys. I don't know what you're talking about.
No, this is not. There isn't America, as my uncle, who's long dead, used to say when Richard J. Daley the first, Richard J. He said that the graft is at an acceptable level. When he first said that, I didn't. Like, Uncle Dan, what the hell are you talking about? But now I know exactly what he meant. Well, there's, when you got human beings involved, there's always a little something to grease the wheels. As long as it's a little something. I mean, I don't think I'm naive enough to think that the guy who got the PT boat motor contract in World War II didn't charge maybe 5% more than the absolute honest open bid would have gotten. but it was 5%. And his employees spent it in the local bars, in restaurants, and people paid taxes on it. That's a lot different than this crap, where you get a contract and you go, that's great. Let's call Greg up and say, hey, will you clean these streets for $1 million? Well, yeah, cool. I just got a contract for 1.5. And then you say to some other dude, some immigrant guy going, hey, will you clean the streets for 750? Yeah, and we're both sitting there happy as a clam, and some poor guy's out there paying illegals and not even paying them. And the idea that the immigration, this is just the latest new excuse, Lou. I mean, in Chicago, the mayor will say he's spending millions of dollars a day on immigration. And yet I see the 50 people that are living in, or 100 people living in a place by me, they don't have any money. They're all going to work in the morning, like almost half of them now. So, I mean, they're doing their... I don't see somebody giving those guys $100 bills. Where's the dough?
Yeah.
Man, yeah. It's...
Like I said, it's useful from the perspective of giving us a picture of what's happening on the ground level. And that may be the... I mean, that's why I think Trump, you know, actually won that debate, even though with Harris, you know, everybody said, well, she scored more points than he did, and he couldn't keep himself from reacting to the personal taunts. Of course, now
there's a lot of funny bumper stickers
now
here.
We know apparently she was given the questions in advance, or at least sample questions in advance, and some other stuff, which totally invalidates the whole thing. But I call Trump the winner because we're still talking about cats.
That's exactly what these bumper stickers are about.
Yeah, we're still talking about cats.
Well, that's what the big lie is all about. Some people are going to believe it long after it's debunked. 40%.
No. That's not the issue. The issue is that the reason it's a win is because, in addition to talking about cats, we're digging into this whole exactly what is going on there.
And, you are.
Pardon me?
I mean, the...
Well, no. I mean, you can read, if you read the stories that are... I mean, the mainstream press isn't covering this, but a lot of other people are, and enough information is getting out to talk about how these folks are having their income supplemented, how they're much cheaper than Native American workers because of government money flowing in that you know, eliminates the typical cost an employer has to bear, and so they hire these people rather than hiring the folks that have been living there.
Both sides do nothing but give money to their people. That's what's wrong with politics today.
Well, we just talked about that.
Well, Republicans do the same thing.
I don't see the Republicans in favor of importing, you know, large numbers of third world people into
they turn around and give money to the corporations and the other people. Although now some of the corporations are
that is not the same thing.
It's the same thing. It's still money.
It's no. See, so this goes back to an issue that I was kind of thinking might come up this morning with respect to what's going on in the Middle East, and
assessment. Well, it's gonna come up. I'm dying to talk to you about it.
Okay, well, this just goes back to something you said about, you know, if you put people in Gaza, you know, you restrict their lives, you do all these terrible things to them, which the Israelis aren't. But if you do all this, of course you're gonna have this kind of hit back. And I don't think I articulated it very well the first time around, but I'm gonna articulate it this way. You just said it's all economic. The short answer to that is no, it's not. And as I told somebody the other day, if you think that the people in Gaza were suddenly to find themselves economically secure, you know, upper middle class, with cars, if you think that would stop the attacks on Israel, you're mistaken, because it's not an economic issue. It's an ideological issue, and it has nothing to do with the economics in Gaza or the economics anywhere else. This is a focus by these people on killing Jews. That's what they want, and that's the focus of the operation. And so their aim, and it's the focus of the majority of the population there. So the idea that it's all economic is not quite correct.
I never once said that it was all economic. I said it's the when the economic conditions are like that, it gives rise to extremism, and it gives rise to the seeds of discord.
That is not the motivating factor in Gaza, or in Lebanon. Although right. the Lebanese, most of the Lebanese, I think, are a little more secular. But anyway, that just put that in your hip pocket.
I have it in my hip pocket, and I understand where you're coming from. But I also know that whenever you have a situation like the, you know, let's forget Gaza for a minute. When the first spot was where the Baca Valley, where all the refugees were in refugee camps for what, three generations, and
the big refugee camps initially were Jordan.
I read this piece once from somebody, and it says, here's the problem with being like us, Lou. And today's world is probably, I wish I could find this guy or find this article, because the way the news spins today and the rapidity of it, I wonder what he would think now. But it goes back to, if you're a refugee and you're living in this tent city, You never lose focus of there you are and how bad it sucks. Or the rest of us go on with our life.
I think that's a distinctly Western view.
Okay. I think if you go in the hospital with a broken leg, you really don't take a world view of anything until your leg gets fixed. Even though other people don't seem to care about it, you do. I'm just saying.
Okay.
I'm saying the view of the people in the place where nobody's working and you're getting food from somewhere else, maybe good, maybe bad, and young males especially can't find anything useful to do, I think you find the seeds.
Those people could be rolling in dough and they would still be out there killing Jews.
I think
the vast majority of them, at least that portion of radical Islam.
I'm not going to say the single, because you probably know people who are just as bad. You could take 1920s Germany and didn't even know the name Adolf Hitler, and you and I, if you would have seen films of that area, or we could go back in time and walk through, we would predict exactly what happened. Some tyrant is somehow going to be the number one gang member, which he was, gang leader, and found out a way to have people to follow him because he knew how to speak or do something, and he found somebody to blame it all on, which he did.
That's a Western, what I consider to be a Western world.
His point is
Western European.
He told people, it's not your fault. This what's going on here. It's these Jewish people. It's their fault.
I think that's a Western European worldview.
Okay,
I understand
you're saying that there. That in the Baca Valley, people there didn't say, we're not this screwed up, we're here because of these Jewish people. It's the same message.
No, it's not, and I think that's our failure to understand that and grasp that is part of the reason why we think that we can have something like a two-state solution.
And that's
going to solve the problem.
Well, all I know is if you blow off three of my fingers on a pager, I think you can recruit me to do just about anything against the people who blew my fingers off tomorrow.
Well, I can't recruit you to go shoot a gun.
You can recruit me maybe to put a pack of stuff
and
on
the
me.
The fact that you had the pager already indicates that you were ready to go shoot.
We're never going to sort of agree on this total warfare thing, but what I'm saying, and I think a lot of people here feel the same way, I'm not saying we're right, but if there always are, there used to be somewhat rules to warfare, and of course then there wasn't, and everybody's rules are different. Obviously, people with battleships didn't think submarines should be illegal, so this is not new. What was the story? If you couldn't pick up survivors, you shouldn't be able to destroy somebody's ship or something. Wasn't that the argument? World War I, something like that?
There was a... At some point back in the day when you had vessels moving more slowly and things like that, there was an obligation to, and there still is to a certain extent, to rescue survivors if militarily feasible.
Well, that was the whole point. The submarine didn't have enough room, so... Anyway, but I mean, there's always been these rules of warfare to somebody... But in our situation... And I've never been to Gaza. I mean, I understand that Israel is a small place, and it's not like the U.S. where you feel somewhat secure in Chicago because you got like 1,000 miles of land and an ocean between you and the next bad guy, except for the drug lords. it's a whole different point of view. I mean, I get everybody, I've gone to those APAC things, and the people who come back say it's just so different when you go up on a hill and, like, look at your enemy. I mean, it's just, and it's, you know, it's not what we're used to.
Well, not just look at them.
You can hear them. They're shooting stuff at you.
The enemy's shooting at you actively and doesn't stop.
I get all that. I mean, but I'm saying it is different, but if it's our money involved, if you know, all of a sudden there was a third party and I was a candidate, which I, oh God. First thing I do is I have a conversation with this Netanyahu and I say, okay, you're riding on our dough, which he is. I want to know what your rules of engagement are. I mean, what your rules are.
The Israelis have been very clear about their rules.
Okay, but I just say, what's the end? I mean, tomorrow if he intercepts a thing of baby formula and poisons that, do I want to pay for that? Absolutely not.
That are you equating the pager thing
I'm saying I want to know where the line is.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what the Israelis did and why, in my opinion anyway, it was perfectly legitimate under the rules of war. The both Hezbollah and Hamas and all of the Iranian terror proxies fight in what we would consider to be as unlawful combatants. That is from the get-go. They don't identify themselves with uniforms. They don't engage in a combat in a way that allows us to distinguish them from the civilians that they hide behind. And so, in fact, Hamas leadership has openly admitted that its goal is to get as many civilians killed as possible in Gaza so that they can play off the sympathies of, you know, misguided scholars and other people. So if you start with that, then you are allowed to engage those people in a way that minimizes the casualties, but within the collateral casualties, the civilian casualties, but with the understanding that because of the way they're waging their war, you're going to kill a lot more people than a lot more civilians than you normally would if you were engaging, you know, a uniformed force that was engaging in so-called lawful combat.
Right. So, in other words,
it's against international law to hide behind a civilian population and to mix yourself into the civilian population. And when you do, you are not in a position legally or, I think, morally to scream when somebody comes in and lays waste to your operation and kills a bunch of civilians behind whom you were hiding.
So if I take that to its extreme, the British were really screwed up by not just walking into Lexington and Concord and killing every civilian there.
No, they were not. They were not.
Well, nobody had a uniform on.
First of all, the rules of war, the law of war, was not codified to the extent that it is now.
But who writes the rules? The winners.
Well, I mean, the international community has accepted certain limitations on combat, and they have for over 100 years. So the short answer, and you can say the winners write the rules. And if you say that, then okay, then we just go to win and we kill everybody. The point is that if you engage in this kind of stuff, if you hide behind civilians, you can't. The war crime is not being committed by the attacking force, except in limited circumstances. The war crime is being committed by the guys who are hiding behind the civilians. And you don't pin the moral blame or the legal blame on the attacking force. You pin it on the guys who were hiding behind the civilians. What Israel did with these pagers and the radios yesterday is engage in as selective an attack as you can imagine against an opponent that has effectively declared war on it and is engaging in, you know, state-sponsored, you know, military action against the country.
The thing I object, one of the things I object to, Lou, and again, I'm very pro-Israel. I want to ask you a very serious question.
Just so we're clear. The use of those devices to inflict casualties, not kill, but to injure and inflict casualties like that, is highly selective, It is, it minimizes collateral damage, and it maximizes the profits.
All right, so here's the issue I have with that, and I won't compare you to Rumsfeld. If 15 of the wrong people, 12-year-old girls got blown up, he's going to say, hey, we did our best. I'm going to say, eh, what if it was 100, what if it was 500? We did our best. There's a casualness about the non-combatants getting hurt as well that I just have a problem with.
Okay.
It can get too big. Now, if this whole mess of the 2,600 people...
Okay, so let me run that out, because that you have touched on a very important point, and that is that had they simply dropped 15,000 pagers and put them into general circulation and then detonated them, that would be, in my opinion, illegal. That would be a violation of international law.
So that's
not selective.
That's
not
your
discriminating
line. So there is a line.
Oh yeah, yeah. You can't just indiscriminately do that. That's why this was genius. I mean, they hit a group of people that were almost exclusively, as far as I can tell, Hamas people, because they had these pagers and that's how they were communicating.
What about the people who made them? Do they get to do that? Do they get to choose? Do they get to ship something to somebody they know has got a bomb in it?
I'm sorry, what?
The people who made them. Do they get? If I get a contract from, God knows who, and you're my enemy, do they get to put a bomb in it and send it to you? Where do they get off doing that?
Okay, so we're talking about, so the people that made those devices, that made them explosives,
yeah,
were military or government operatives acting on behalf of their state.
All right, so do you know how this, I'm asking, I don't know, I was looking last night and I can't find, how did the supply chain work? There's allegedly a factory in Hungary, a place that has a license from the people from Taiwan to make these pagers. So they make the pagers in this factory and they got 5,000 of them sitting there. All right, so now, Is the factory infiltrated by Mossad and they put the explosives in their building, or does it, instead of being shipped directly, it gets shipped to a siding somewhere?
My understanding is that the Mossad or the agents controlled the assembly of those devices to the extent that they were putting explosive charges in them.
Right. So is the Hungarian government involved?
No.
Well, how do you know?
But I absolutely am convinced the Hungarian government is not involved.
All right, so if they were put together in, say, Chicago and shipped over there, do you think there'd be a few questions about who the hell these guys are in Chicago and where do they get off doing that?
There are a ton of questions about who the heck these guys are in Budapest and how they get off doing it. Did you see the building where they're headquartered?
You're saying it all was done in the factory. Wow.
What I'm assuming is that at some stage in the assembly process, and I'm not the I just saw the head of the Chinese company, the Taiwanese company, who said they bought our name to assemble these things.
Well, that part
make,
I get.
No, wait a minute. We didn't make any of these. They did it under a license from us to use our name for manufacturing these devices.
And probably the patents.
And we sold the licensing rights to them, but we didn't have any quality control. We didn't do anything else. We simply gave them permission to use this model number.
All right. So, but you're saying that what I'm trying to get the answer to here, and I don't know if you know it, but I think you have a better idea than me. In that building, when they were originally packed, they were bombs. They weren't packed, put on a pallet. The pallet got hijacked for 2 days, and guys took it all apart again, put it back together.
No, I don't think so. And in fact, if you see, as I said, did you see the building where they worked? It's a house. The address for that company is a house. By the way,
yeah, 5,000 of them. You must have some kind of factory floor.
Well, you keep saying that, but we don't know. So what? I saw the building. The building is a mail drop for a number of other entities. The Hungarian government is saying we don't have any reference or record of these guys doing any business or paying any taxes. I think what happened was they figured out a way to get a bunch of these pagers. They go to the, they buy up a group of them. Their intel on this Tom, has got to be unbelievably good.
Yeah, oh yeah.
They find out that there's going to be a big order of these things. They find out the model that they want to use. They get on the open market. They blind purchase 5,000 of these things that they know are going to be supplied to Hezbollah, not to anybody else, to Hezbollah. They find out that they buy up a bunch of this stuff. They have a buyer. Hezbollah is contacted a buyer or a seller. They go to they have this seller in their hip pocket. They buy up 5,000 of these things at some location, not in Budapest, which is where this company is that's bought the name, but somewhere else. They take them apart and they insert into them one of two things, and this is where it gets...
You realize what you're doing is you're totally indicting the people in Taiwan. You're saying they actually did manufacture them, and somewhere in the shipment process they got snagged.
I'm just saying they manufactured these devices. The Mossad or whomever purchased, you know, figured out that they were going to have that the Hezbollah was going to be ordering this model. Okay, they then go in on the open market and they buy 5,000 of these things from the Taiwanese through various sources. I suspect they didn't buy them all at once, and I suspect they didn't buy them all from the same place.
You're probably 100% correct, but you totally negated the part that these guys bought the license. That's BS then.
Well, the Chinese sell them the right to use the name or use the symbol. And that, I mean, this is what the guy from China said, the Taiwanese
all right, but,
the CEO
okay, but
said.
Let's without beating a dead horse here. If I can buy a license from somebody, it says I get to put a tractor together. I still got to buy the wheels. I got to buy all the stuff to put the tractor together, and I can put the name John Deere on it. That's the license I buy. But yep. if I got a house or my apartment, sure in hell not putting the tractor together in my house. Now, am I actually buying all the stuff from the people in Taiwan that say there's 8 parts in there?
They didn't buy the part. What I think they did is they went out on the market and again, this is that level of planning. Think about the level of planning.
Right, so you're saying they actually were manufactured in Taiwan?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, they bought the original items.
Right.
So the idea of them just
having a license and they never came close to Taiwan is all BS.
Exactly.
Okay.
They set up a dummy company that's going to sell these pagers to Hezbollah at a cheap price. The agent says, okay, I'm going to deliver 5,000 of these to you by X date, 6 months from now. Okay? Hezbollah goes, great. That seller is a Mossad agent. A Mossad front. That's BAC.
All right. All I'm saying is, if you're correct, which I think you are, then the guy in Taiwan is full of crap.
No, the guy from Taiwan doesn't know anything.
Well, he sure does. He sold 5,000 to somebody. He actually assembled them.
No, he didn't know. He doesn't know that he sold. Remember, I told you they didn't buy 5,000 all at once.
Right, but
they maybe bought 500. But or 100.
When I if I were to tell you that I sold you the licensing, or the name and the licensing. It implies that you did all the manufacture and you put the thing together on your own and you stamped my name on it because I gave you the processes.
That's not what happened.
It doesn't appear.
That's what the Chinese think happened. They're not going to know. They're not going to know that these guys were simply buying.
Or they weren't. They're not going to admit to it, even if they do know.
Well, trust me. This, you are not you in an operation like this. You are not. You're going to put double blind walls up everywhere. So the Chinese would not know anything. They would just know that they sold the name. Okay, fine. This is apparently something they do. So they get these pagers. They buy them out on the open market. They assemble. They get a group of them together, 5,000 of them together. And then they alter them somewhere else. Not in Budapest.
How long do you think it takes per pager to alter? How big of an operation?
It depends how many people you have working.
I'm saying how much you think
what the alteration was.
If you and
let,
I, well,
let
you,
me let me
right,
let me
you
say
put
this.
A they put what an eraser sized thing of explosive in there and some sort of a
this is where my questions come up. I can see how they could do all this pretty readily, but here figure this. You can't just slap an explosive, even one that's been sealed in a pager, and not have residue or detection, the possibility of detection. I mean, these things go through airports, they go through scanners. My take on this is they did something to some, and oh, by the way, if you happen to look at it and you know that they, that the Hezbollah would have looked at it, it's going to look perfectly normal. So I think they did something else. I think they modified a component that they simply had to just drop in that would look exactly the same if you pulled the back off it.
Without a doubt.
And so what you're talking about, so that you don't have to resolder and pull wires and stuff like that out of there, what you're talking about is some kind of self-contained drop-in thing that they could pull the back off, pop it in, pop the back back on, and the thing works. And the most likely, to me, the most likely way of doing that is to modify a battery, one of the batteries, or a battery, so that you literally pull the battery that works the thing out. You drop in one of your modified batteries.
You had to get into the control piece because it didn't go off till somebody pressed a button.
Well, that's the, again, you don't need to. You can put a detonator in there inside the battery, a small radio detonator that operates only at a certain frequency, up and way up and above the frequency that the pager works at. And so, I mean, this is one way of doing it.
By the way, you're showing your age when you said wire it. I don't think you're going to find a regular wire in these things.
Well, no, but you would have a wire. The detonator would involve
a wire. Yeah, Kevin thinks you could probably, if you did it right, you probably could do it in 5 minutes.
So you manufacture, you know, Israel manufactures 5,000 of these batteries in Israel. The pagers arrive at some location, these modified batteries, and the batteries contain, you know, 5 grams of some kind of nitroglycerin-based explosive, because you want enough power.
Said it was the size of an eraser pencil, a pencil eraser.
Yeah. Okay. So that fits. Excuse me. That fits in the battery, and you like, it's like a lithium battery, you a photo battery. You cut that thing in half. You basically have it so that it'll run for, you know, 6 months, and you, the other half of the battery is this explosive and the radio detonator. That gets placed in the battery. The battery is sealed, and then you make 5,000 of them. And then when these pagers are ready, you just pop the backs off. You pull the old battery out. You put the new battery in, and then voila, you have 5,000 little bombs. And those go out to Hezbollah. And your intel is so good that you know that they're not handing them out. They're just not handing them out on the street. These are Hezbollah pagers. They are used by Hezbollah for communication. And you let them operate. They operate for, you know, 3, 4, 5 months until you're ready to send that radio signal out across southern Lebanon that triggers the explosive.
Well, it doesn't really. You got to press the button.
I'm sorry?
You got to press the button.
What button?
That's how they made sure that people got their hands blown off. Obnoxious pager thing went off, and you went to turn the pager off, and that's when it blew.
Well,
that's how they made sure it didn't blow up in people's suitcases and lockers. It only blew up if you were near somebody.
It blew up. It blew up. I saw a video of one that had blown up on somebody's desk.
It sat on the desk
and then went off.
Okay, the two things I read. They said it didn't go off until somebody pressed the thing to turn the obnoxious pager thing off. That's why it cut somebody's hands and abdomens and stuff like that.
Yeah, I saw a video. I saw a video of the stuff. At least one that had gone off by, you know, sitting on a tabletop.
All right,
without
well,
anybody near it.
All right, we got a few minutes left, Lou. What do you think?
Think about the intelligence that you needed to be able to.
When you have a bunch of people along the way that.
Yeah,
co-opted stuff.
And if you're Hezbollah, you're walking around going, "Who was it? Who did they get to? And how many of them do they have?" Especially after the second wave of radios blowing up yesterday.
Well, yeah, I mean it's quite the deal. And I said when you start talking about, you know, the rules of warfare, They obviously change, right? I mean, as time goes by, and the winners.
No, this was the functional equivalent of having 5,000 snipers positioned around southern Lebanon, and at the signal, they all shoot guys.
Well, let me ask you this: what, other than just being generally worried about their own place in history and their own power and stuff, the people in Iran? I mean, I can, I won't say understand, but at least have a grip on why some of the people around Israel are not too fond of the Israelis. Okay, I mean, you know, property's been taken, whatever. I mean, there's reasons there. I'm not saying reasons enough to go kill somebody. Absolutely not. But there's, what exactly, I mean, there's no border between Israel and Iran. Iran's in Persia. They're not even Arabs. They're not Palestinians. What is their basically bitch with Israel other than trying to keep themselves in power and needing an enemy? What, I don't get the history there.
They're Islamic fundamentalists.
Okay.
And if you go back to the Hadith and to the teachings of Muhammad, he tells them to kill Jews.
Well, that would do it. Yeah, I did not know that. I'm sorry, I should have known that. I guess.
Yeah, I mean, if they are, Iran is run by a particularly.
So might I assume Hitler was a Muslim? What the hell?
No. There's lots of anti-Semitism, you know, historically in the world, that a lot of it is generated. A lot of it is generated simply by the fact that the Jewish community has been crazily successful.
Well, a lot of it with the Catholic people started when Catholics weren't allowed to charge interest, and the Jews stepped into that void.
That's part of it.
But that was long, you know. That's long.
But I mean, from radical Islam can point to a number of provisions that instruct its members to kill Jews, and so that
not just Jews. No.
Yeah, unbelievers.
Yeah,
right.
So, but there's specific entreaties to kill Jews in the Hadith.
But I mean, you don't see them having, you know, waves of conflict where they're trying to kill a pope or something. I mean, they obviously don't like Catholics either. But I mean, what I'm saying
there's not a specific provision in
okay
the Quran or these other books that I'm aware of that says go kill Christians, but there is specific stuff about killing Jews and other unbelievers. They're and you know, Tom, the big thing that drives the Iranians crazy is they see themselves as the power brokers there. They want to be the power brokers, and Israel stands in the way.
Well, does Iran, when you see these people in power.
So do the Saudis, by the way, and they've attacked the Saudis.
Well, I mean, you see these people in power, and that's why I'm so concerned about people you put in power anywhere. I think there would have been a Palestinian solution if Yasser Arafat didn't think he'd be out if there was a solution. I mean, I worry about Netanyahu the minute this is over. He's out because nobody really likes him, and clearly the Iranian government seems to think that this is keeping them in power somehow. I mean, is there any more unpopular government than the people in Iran, for God's sake? They got to be right up there.
I mean, the Iranians have a death grip on their population.
Well, that's what I mean.
Up until you know, the end of the Shah's regime, were fairly cosmopolitan and quite westernized.
I don't know a whole bunch. Lou, you probably know a hell more because you get around a lot. I probably know 7 to 8 people from Iran. Every one of them can't stand these people. They all are extremely well-educated, extremely hard-working, and they can't believe there are places like that. And a couple of them can't go home because they're engineers and said they'll never let them back out. I mean, it's. I mean, obviously, you know Fari's view of the place.
Iranians, there's a couple of really interesting books about Iran that are out that talk about what the culture is like, and it's almost like there are two worlds working there. You have the Islamic fundamentalist leadership culture with the guys walking around beating women who have their hair uncovered, and you know, secret police kidnapping people who would criticize the government in the middle of the night, you know, real Stalin type stuff.
Gee, is it hard to find a bunch of guys that like to beat women?
Except with a religious bent. And then you've got a huge proportion of the population that, you know, tries to the extent that they can follow Western mores and is well educated and as I said, fairly cosmopolitan, and you know, as long as they don't bump up against the religious fanatics, their outlook could be considered almost Western.
Well, when the Shah, it sure was, right?
Right, and so it's very similar to what you see if you go back, and I know I've mentioned this, if you pull up a Life or a Time magazine from the 1950s or the 1960s, and you look, and there are pictures in there of Kabul in Afghanistan, and you see pictures of women and men walking around in Western dress, in Western, you know, Western restaurants, Western clothes, Western mores, that are gradually moving in to effectively raise the living standard of this entire area, and you know, that maybe that's it in a nutshell. That was definitely a threat to the crazies living out in the wild, who are the conservative, the fundamentalist Islamists, who view this as a religious issue. It's not economic. They would rather be in squalor and terrible living conditions than have economic prosperity and them not in total control.
Is it city versus country, like it kind of was in Afghanistan or in Iran, or is the city more? I mean, is it a smaller town in Iran? Are they definitely more conservative, or are they more? Or does it depend on the town?
It definitely was city versus country to the extent that you know the tribal folks out there in Afghanistan are the source of the Taliban's strength.
But the religion is also the source of their power, right?
I'm sorry?
The religion is also the source of that guy's power.
Well, the ideology, the belief in the ideology, yeah, is the source of the focus. That's what unites these people.
I mean, the reason why the Ayatollah, whatever the hell the guy's name is, the reason why he's in power is because he can beat people up with the Quran over the head. I mean, basically.
Yeah, that's his guiding principle, I would say. Yeah, so you have effectively a government that's being run by ideologues, and that's why I keep making the reference here. I mean, a government run by ideologues, which are not operating according to what you and I would consider to be their economic best interest, and frankly, we don't get that. I don't think any of our people get that. Certainly our State Department people, based on what I saw with Blinken yesterday, our State Department people don't seem to understand that. And, you know, to a lesser extent, and I believe this about Donald Trump, to a lesser extent, I think Donald Trump doesn't really understand it, and the people around him.
I don't think
he's a mercantilist.
I try not to be a dummy. I've learned, you know, I love to argue with you, but I don't agree with you. It's a lot of stuff. I've learned so much from you regarding this thing that you have to. It's the line from The Godfather. You know, my father learned how to put his mind in the other people's head. And I've learned a little bit from you. I hope the listeners have too. So thank you for that. You're right. But real quick story, and we got to go to Dan. You know. I never even asked you your religion, but obviously,
Tom, this goes back, and it's not just places like Iran. Vladimir Putin operates on this.
Well, sure, that's where you first got to me. But we had I used to go to Saint Chan Fisher, right? Was my and then we went to Saint Bernard. I forget which place it was. Well, I think it was Saint Bernard's. We had a visiting priest, right? And the normal priest, you know, he gives the homily on Sunday, and he reads a part of the gospel, and then he basically tells you what the lesson for that is, and there's, you know, there's families in there, and there's people of all different ages, so you gotta keep it cool, right? Yet when I went to Notre Dame, when you went to church there, the priest spent like 5 days on his sermon, right? It was some serious crap. You know, the guys spent a lot of time. It was a serious moral issue, it was serious something something. It was something you left thinking about, right? Because he spent a lot of time putting it together, making you think about, well, St. Bernard's has got this visiting guy in there one day. And he gets up there and he starts talking about, well, you know, more economic wars were fought in the name of religion than any other reason. The place is going, who the hell is this guy? I don't think he was ever invited back, but I'm sitting there going, the guy's absolutely right. Correct?
Well, yeah. And this, when you see that kind of anti or irrational, you know, fervor and decision making, you know, that's when you say, okay, the you know, irrational to us, the economics that we use or economic bases we use are not driving this decision.
But I think a lot of it has to do with the idea some people just have to be, you know, leaders, and I won't say leaders, you have to be tyrants. And if religion's what gets them to be a tyrant, if having more wealth than everybody else gets you to be a tyrant, they use whatever means they can.
I mean, you can make a pretty good case for that just looking at the history of Christianity. In the
West. Without a doubt. But who wants to be the tyrants here? The people who have somehow gotten amazing wealth during our governmental policies on money in the last 25 years. They want to be the tyrants. You think Bill Gates doesn't want to be in charge? And all these people? I mean, and I don't, the idea that he's left or he's right. The fact is, these people think that they somehow are better than other people and got it figured out. I don't think you could wage a war here based on a religion, certainly not the Catholics. Nobody goes to church. I mean, but the economic piece, you think Elon Musk doesn't think he deserves to be like president? I mean,
I don't think Musk thinks he deserves anything.
He deserves to be able to tell the president what to do and the president do it.
I don't know about that.
Well, one guy bought a newspaper. So he could tell people what to do. I mean,
all of them buy newspapers.
Yeah, I mean,
Chief.
This is crazy.
They buy football teams too.
Well, that's right. If Dan can wait one second, I had a conversation the other night with my buddy Bill Murphy, who's from Marquette, one of my best friends. He's an attorney. He was a Marquette. Every time I see him, I think of you, Lou, and no, because he's a little bit older than us. You're going to ask me why, because he went to Marquette on a football ride, and Marquette ixnayed the football team, I think, when he was a freshman.
Yeah.
But Bill was, they used to have intercollegiate boxing back then, and he kept his ride by saying, hey, if you want to box on the boxing team, you can keep your scholarship. So I thought of, gee, who else do I know played football and boxed, and your name just popped right in my head. Two of you guys would have
Is his brain as rattled as mine is?
Actually, you know, he played football everywhere, played softball forever, played baseball for, I mean, he was a softball player, really good one. You know, only age made him stop playing, but and now he's a voracious golfer at age 81, for God's sake. It's just the same sort of thing. But anyway, what he told me is that Marquette is not, they're not going to do any of the NIL for the basketball team. So my question to you is, he and I were discussing it, and he's sort of curious like I am, and I said, I know just the guy I can ask. I'll ask Lou. If Marquette decides, and there are going to be a lot of these teams that do this, if they decide not to participate in this, and they're going to spend, you know, 20 grand a recruit, or 25 or 50, whatever hell takes a recruit in the door, and they're going to coach him for a year or two, and the guy's going to get picked off by, you know, going over Notre Dame or Connecticut or whoever the hell. Notre Dame's not really doing that in basketball, but for essentially they're gonna pluck the guy out for money. I think that pretty soon, Lou, and again, tell me I'm all wet, you don't have a problem doing that. Somewhere along the line, Marquette's contract with this guy is going to be, look, this is what it costs for you to be here. This is what it costs for your education, for recruiting, for the coaching. And if you leave after 2 years, you owe us X back, or the other team has to essentially compensate us for what we've done to bring you to this level, just like a minor league baseball team would do.
That is a reasonable economic solution. Whether you'd get anybody who would agree to sign an agreement like that and come play for you, I don't know. But that would be a reasonable fix. So the question is now, we're not going to give you NIL money, and we're going to make you sign an agreement to pay us back if you leave early?
Well, or we own your contract for 4 years, and the other guy's got it. I don't know how it would land. Well, I'm just saying nobody's going to do that if all of a sudden the guys just go every freshman year.
Yeah, I don't see that. I don't see that happening. But it would be a rational economic response to what's happening.
Well, we got to go to Dan, but that's what the baseball teams around here I think do. The ones that are not affiliated with the major leagues, they hold tryouts. They do this. And twice a year, somebody gets grabbed by a major league. I think they have to
They do, but they've got leverage because they're providing an entry level in. The schools typically don't. If this kid's good enough to be that you're worried about him being pulled off in a portal, then a portal move, then...
But you're talking about kids that are 17 to 19 years old. Who knows what happens in that 2 years? I mean, they're not all Michael Jordans, where you could tell in high school they're that good.
But the vast majority of them are going to sign something like that.
All right. Well, I'm just... Somehow or another, schools are not going to put all this money together, and after sophomore year, everybody just leaves. And yet, I don't
agree.
And yet, I don't think a lot of the... I was talking to Russell yesterday, and it wasn't about Indiana. He's from Indiana, like talking about his own school, because I don't know what I'm talking about school. But, but I don't think Purdue's up for this. We're just going to spend 15 people running around bidding for people all day long, which is what's happening.
Yeah. Well, and of course, my alma mater, the service academies, are not in it at all.
By the way, you guys joining the Pac-12?
No. They're being bum rushed right now by the All American Conference.
I thought the rumor I had the other night was that they're going to be the only team that's not named State in the Pac-12 or Pac-10.
That would be tough, but we'll see. I don't think we have the fan base to make the Pac-12 attractive.
Make
us attractive to the Pac-12.
Well, who are you guys up? Something State, was it Montana? What are the guys at the Blue Field? They're joining, right?
Yeah, Boise.
Boise State. And somebody,
Fresno State, Boise State, Colorado State.
Utah State?
I don't know if Utah State was pulled in there or not.
All right, Lou, we gotta let you go. Have a good week, buddy. And if all this stuff keeps going on in the Middle East, I might reserve the right to call you in for a few minutes. Let us know what's going on.
Give me a yell.
Okay,
talk
buddy.
To you later.
SP Bye. Futures up 91, NASDAQ Futures up 420. Just the man we want to talk about with that, Mr. Dan Janinas. Might as well go right to him. We'll do a break at the end of the half hour. Dan, you with us?
I'm here.
Way too many problems in the world today, eh? In addition to what's going on in the market.
Agreed. Agreed. Yeah, but we're. I think the news in the market was pretty noteworthy yesterday.
Why did we sell off?
Well, we sold off initially, I think, because there's sort of two sides of this. There's concerns that the Fed's going to move too quickly. I actually think they should have waited and just done 25. There's a lag effect to their cuts, right? So it's going to take a number of months before we actually see it trickle down to the economy and what impact it's going to have on the economy. So I think it was a little bit much. So I think that's why we saw the sell-off. But as you just mentioned, we're seeing the futures up huge today because people then think through what actually will happen. I mean, one thing that's obvious for me is bonds, as rates come down, bond prices go up. And I've been saying this for months and months. Once we start cutting, that's going to be good news for bonds. And sure enough, we're seeing some pretty good performance here just from the move yesterday, but also from the anticipation of this move in bonds across the board. It's also good for equities because it will be a lower cost of capital. And that particularly applies to tech stocks and some of the small cap stocks, which we're now taking a closer look at. Small cap stocks, but not necessarily tech stocks.
Dan, you just gave the theory, all right, and what's supposed to happen. And you know what? I absolutely would. I'm no professor, but I would say Dan gets an A. None of the stuff in the last 5 to 8 years that was supposed to happen happened. We went from 0% rates to 5.5%, and the market damn near doubled.
Well, I think part of that was just the huge influx of money in the system.
Well,
that was, I think, one thing that was different. We had a huge cut in corporate taxes, which brought a lot of money into the market. Brought a lot of money in the economy. And then we also had COVID relief. We had a continued you know, like spigot of money just pouring into the system. And so I think that is what has kept inflation high. And with inflation being high, it's not just housing prices and food prices, it's also the stock market. I mean, the stock market is experiencing, we're at record highs still. So it's that influx of money, it's that pumping money into the system for so many of the last years. I have not agreed with all those moves. I don't think it's the best thing. I think we're overheated still. The best thing probably is going to be some sort of at least small cut in corporate taxes. I think that's necessary to bring us back to normalcy here. We're still kind of running away. I do think the reaction is, and even I listened very carefully to Powell, they don't even know how this 50 basis points is going to impact.
Okay, did you get through it carefully without going for the air sickness bank?
There were, you know, initially I thought it was good, and towards the end of the conversation, the two biggest things that hit me are the dual mandate of maximum employment and stable prices. Well, yesterday and today I'm in a virtual conference for small cap companies, and I'm asking each of these companies those two issues, and I ask them anyways. I've been asking those questions for years. What do you see in terms of your costs? Have your costs gone up? Have they stayed the same? And in most cases, and in nearly every case, they've either stayed the same or gone up. And I'm talking about over the last year. So we're hearing that inflation's coming down, but I don't know about you. When I go to the grocery store, it doesn't seem like we're seeing that.
I think they totally abandoned yesterday any attempt to fight the price level that they created. And don't even really care if inflation's 3 or 4%. They just keep saying their goals that's why you see the markets doing this. They're going to start.
Absolutely, there's definitely concern about the impact. The other side of the coin is the maximum employment. Well, they're looking at numbers, and as we've talked before, where are they getting this information? Because my little survey of people, you know, CEOs of these companies who I've been talking to. And just seeing what's happening to people I know in terms of employment, yes, there's been cutbacks in certain industries, especially tech. You know, there has been, you know, the move towards automation in a lot of industries. There's been less training, as we've discussed in the past. But the companies that I've spoken to at this conference are all saying the same thing. They are still finding challenges and finding the best talent, and they're still having to pay top dollar. So from a cost point of view on the wage side, they're still paying top dollar. There's not been any
they're paying, and this is not a criticism of these people, their idea of top dollar, I mean, I was in a restaurant where they were paying the cook $12, they raised them to $15, they thought it was top dollar when they raised all the prices of the dinners $4. I mean, I guess, and I'm not saying they aren't paying top, you know what I'm saying? I mean, somebody's view of top dollar is maybe not somebody else's.
I'm talking about like larger companies.
Yeah, I understand.
Like small mid-cap companies that are hiring engineers and you know they're hiring salespeople and marketing people and operations people, and they're having to pay more still today than they have in the past. We have seen wage inflation, but what's happening and also to go to your point about even restaurants. There are challenges. I've talked to several restaurant owners recently. There are challenges to them because there's a lot of restrictions, and that some of that's geographic, on having to hire people, having to pay certain wages, having to provide certain benefits. So that's a trend. But what I'm saying is actually even more basic than that. Because of inflation, most positions, and let's talk more about professional positions, or at least mid-level management positions, people are not having trouble finding work. They're not having trouble finding getting paid the salaries they want. I know some companies have made people come back into the office, but many have allowed remote work. And what companies are realizing is, in order to get the best talent, you're going to have to continue to offer those benefits, and one of them being, you know, the ability to work remotely. So we're not quite there. I think Powell thinks we're further ahead than we actually are. And that's what my criticism of him saying we've reached this, because he's looking at a specific number as opposed to really looking at the true situation of what's happening out there. He's smart to say that there's a lag effect, but we have to wait we have to wait a little longer, I think, and I think we have to take this process of cutting rates a little bit slower.
I think that their dual mandate is absolutely at the back of the truck, and right now it's preserving the asset bubble for the people that have money. I know that's amazingly cynical, but nothing. When that guy talks about inflation, how does somebody, alleged people, I mean, people are supposed to know something. Well, I don't know if she does or not. Listen to Elizabeth Warren. Oh God, oh God.
She doesn't.
I mean, I've heard Powell talk about, you know, it was in the debate as well. I mean, the idea. They did this to us. That guy's going to talk about supply chain problems. He's going to talk about, you know, he had a hemorrhoid. He's going to talk about something. He's never going to say, we created the inflation by putting 40% more money in the system in 18 months. It's never been done anywhere except Egypt or Argentina or Weimar.
Right.
And they'll never once say, and if you don't admit what the problem is or was, how are you going to fix it?
How do you fix it? I agree.
Now, the last 5 months, they've had the money supply. I'm gonna guess, Dan, and I'll buy a high-end drink over at the series. I'm gonna guess that this month the bulge in the money supply is dramatic. Did you see the?
I think it's gonna be sustainable. I think it's definitely gonna be high. Dramatic.
Did you see the find it here. I know. I think I saved it, Dan. You know, I'm not good at this stuff. You guys are much better at this than me. Where am I here? I got the blowing through U.S. Department of the Treasury. Here we go. In the Resource Center. Let's see. I got the. Hold on. I've got the last 15 days of the 1 month T-bill rate. You probably already know this, but I'm going to read this.
Yeah, I was
going to
mention this.
I mean, a 9.3, which wasn't that far ago. Whoa, we're up to do that the day after Labor Day. 5.38, I'm going to go day by day. 5.33, 5.30, 5.28, 5.25, 5.18, one day a little bit of blip. 5.21, 5.818, 5.15, 5.11, 5.05, 4.91. How much money do you think they put in the last 2 weeks? For that to happen,
I agree, and that's part of what's brought down. I think there's other reasons that, again, as I've talked before, a lot of some of this happens when the money is coming from, you know, investors in general. People are still seeing a relatively high rate. They're still trying to lock in, even if it's only a 6 month or 1 year T-bill. You're still going to make money when rates go down. So this is a period right now where it does make sense to lock in rates when we see the Fed saying they're seeing at least another 50 basis point cut by the end of the year. So as rates go lower, yes, the price of your bonds go up, but people want to lock in that higher rate. So.
Well, Dan, you've been, certainly from what I've seen you do with some of the people, the money you're managing, and obviously what you talk about, you've been negotiating this thing like a fine-tuned captain. Now, there was a dude on yesterday, and I couldn't really see it was who the guy was, but because TV is kind of an odd spot, but I could hear him, and he was one of these old line dudes. I'm not saying because he's older that he's smarter. I'm not going to do that. And he was talking about how yes, they've lowered this rate, but actually the 10 and 30 year rates went up yesterday, and he was saying he says what they're going to do. We're going to get another round of inflation, and one of these days. Which I didn't, I've been sort of predicting this a little bit, but he goes, one of these days we're going to have an auction where the 30 and the 10 are going to come in like a point and a half higher than the day before, just like what happened in Britain or whatever. He goes, because people are going to get the idea that this inflation is not going away, it's staying, and even if it's 4%, there's no way that your 10 years should be 3.7. He goes, well, one of these days there's going to be this adjustment and it's going to be 6 or 6.5. It's going to happen all of a sudden in 1 week. He goes, and nobody's prepared for that, but that's exactly what's going to happen.
Well, that's why we're saying stay away from longer-term bonds, yeah. And that would be anything from 2 years out.
Well, do you think he's all wet?
There's more upside. There's more potential of getting whipsawed with rates going up on the longer end of the curve. We know they're going to come down on the short end. We know the yield curve is going to be positive, which means lower rates are going to be lower I mean, shorter rates are going to be lower than higher, longer term rates. And we've been inverted, meaning higher, shorter rates were higher than longer rates for a long time. But we're in the process of that changing. And despite the difference in this cycle, it's still the same. We're still going to see the same impact. And we're going to see a yield curve that's positively sloping coming up. And that could happen. That'll happen two ways. It'll happen from short rates coming down from the Fed cutting rates, and it'll happen from long rates going up based on either the possibility of inflation or just not enough interest from investors in the bond market. And or they think, oh, this rally is over. We're still going to see a rally in short-term rates. That there's no question that's happening. That's a given.
But
longer rates, I'm sort of on the fence. I'm kind of in the middle when it comes to what you're saying. I'm not sure we're going to see higher rates anytime soon. We will if the impact of these cuts is inflationary.
Well, I get.
We will if there's.
But we've had. For a long period of time, and I'm not. I'm sensitive to this, obviously, because of when I started in the business world, or when I saw people doing when I was in college. I'm sensitive to this, but why? I mean, I firmly believe there's no such thing as a stupid person, but why collectively, as a country, and maybe as the world, have people been willing? Maybe they couldn't do anything else. Have people been willing to lend money to people? Either governments or rich people, way less than the inflation rate, and don't realize that when they get the check 5 years from now, they just got screwed. There's no thought of that. I mean, I could be anywhere with a group of eight somewhere, and somebody will want to talk about the economy, not me, never, and they'll say, "Gee, what's wrong with 3.7% for 10 years?" I go, "What if the inflation's 5? You lose." What do you mean? They have no idea what I'm talking about. I don't get that.
Yeah, because we're not there right yet. We're not there right now, so they don't see that the trend could move in that direction. They're just looking at
how many people in the last? I mean, we talk about people that are invested in short term stuff, which recently people are making some money. But how many years did you and I talk where the Fed rate was 1.5% and the inflation rate was 10?
Right.
I mean, talk about losing 8.5% a year. Oh, you could have been an NVIDIA. You could have been this. You could have, but it's pretty hard to put somebody 85 years old in a risky stock. They ought to be able to at least maintain the inflation rate in the bank, and they haven't.
And the one thing I will agree with you on, and I'm not sure that I don't necessarily see this as being a – I do think in general the Fed is trying to – they're targeting the 2% inflation rate, but I will agree with you that part of the reason that we've had – rates low for a long time is it really benefits a lot of, certainly it benefits the tech companies who we've seen this major rally. These were companies that didn't have operating history. They didn't have free cash flow. And to a certain degree, there is some, influence that happens when rates are being kept low. And that influence is going to be one that helps certain companies and help certain people, as you're discussing as well. It helps certain people over others. And one of the commentators made a was talking yesterday about the top 1% and how those are the people that are voting for Trump is talking about lowering taxes and all this, but the point is he's going to need a lot more than the top 1%, right, to get elected, and it just, I just don't think it's going to happen, and I don't think it would be the best thing for our economy. But the focus I think needs to be on the entire, say, investor base or the entire population when we're looking at issues like rates and how they're going to impact people. The other thing that we're looking at is the decline in interest rates and mortgage rates, right? So the concern though for a lot of people who are younger and a lot of people who are in the market for the first time is the affordability issue. That affordability issue has been there for years and years and years, and it only got worse during COVID. So that is going to be a barrier to entry. It's going to remain a barrier to entry for a lot of people. Theoretically, lower rates will help. But as you're saying, and I agree with you, short-term rates coming down is not the same as the 10-year coming down.
No, 10-year was up yesterday.
Mortgage rates are based off of the 10-year. Yeah. Not off of the Fed funds rate. They're based off of changes in the rate of the 10-year Treasury. And you're right, they actually went up a little bit, and so did the 30-year. It's up over 4% now. So there's, in the short run, we're seeing this, we're seeing this sort of setback or this comeback in mortgage rates, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's sustainable.
Well, Dan, two things. Why do we, well, people lob the news out there and people pick it up or don't. I mean, the regular news stations. It was a while ago. I think it was between 2010 and 2020. I traced the interest rates, the Fed fund rate, and it was down from something to something. And in credit card rates actually went up.
Right.
So the idea that I've heard five times since yesterday is how everybody's going to get a break on their credit card rates. Dan, no. It's simply untrue. And how mortgage rates, I think if a short-term rate goes from 5.5 to 4, and the 10-year goes from 3.7 to 4.5 or 5, mortgage rates aren't coming down. I mean, right. I mean, why are we? I never even thought it possible. Dan, what if we were sitting back in school together? Can't wait to get out of class and go grab a beer, and somebody were to say something like, "Well, we're going to have a policy where one group of people gets to borrow money at less than the inflation rate, and the rest of the people we're going to charge like 25% on credit cards." You and I would sit there and go, nobody would do that to their people. You could never have an economy like that. Who would even, if you put it on a blackboard even now, I'm going to say, Dan, you and I may not be able to pick the best stocks all the time. I think I do pretty good for my clients and protection and indexes and all that stuff. By the way, I'm getting an awful lot of concentration issues lately. Like the last four or five clients has all been 90% of their stuff in one stock. Ugh. But, I mean, we're good at it. I mean, I'm happy they're here, and I think we'll do well with them, but that's a challenge. I don't see how you drop that one on Fidelity or Schwab. But anyway, yeah. Talking about an aside. But I would say, Dan, that you'd have to be, if you could, inflation rate was 5% and you can borrow at 2, you'd have to be in an orangutan to lose money. How could you?
Right, and that's what a lot of people have done recently. That's how people have made money.
Yet the people if somebody can, if you and I put a firm together, whether it's asphalt, whether it's medical stuff, whatever it is, whether it's buttons or hula hoops, if we put that place together, and we have to pay, we're probably gonna have to start out on our credit cards, right? Duh. Maybe if we get it rolling a little bit, we get a loan from somebody at 10% or 8 or 9, and all of a sudden we're 3 years into it and we have a successful place and we're making some dough and we got a product that other people are looking at. Somebody can come along and borrow at 2%. They'll be able to buy that place from us at a price we can't touch, and yet it's ridiculously cheap. There's a huge disparity there. There's a discontinuity there. Are we the only two around, and there's other people on this show that realize that that's just wrong?
Yeah, there's always been an advantage to, let's say, larger companies, better capitalized companies, in terms of being able to finance or capitalize at lower rates, right? But there is a disparity between small businesses, and really what the focus needs to be is on how to improve small businesses, because they're really the lifeline of our country, and I want to see us move back towards that the way it was, like you said, when we were in school, where the small business owners were given an equal chance and were.
Well, it was never equal. It was never equal, but it was close to being equal.
It was better than it is today.
But
and
Pullman,
I think that point that you make is really important. That the larger companies have taken a major advantage when it comes to credit. A couple things I wanted to mention with the cut, that you know, the cut in rates. That
hey Dan, could you hang on to that till after the break? We didn't have a first break, but I'll say this: Pullman was a huge borrower because we put together a lot of stuff through Pullman put stuff together through the import export bank. So a lot of like a refinery in Saudi Arabia or someplace would actually run through Pullman's balance sheet, and between the import export bank and the banks here, we were huge favorites of the banks. I guarantee you. When the inflation rate was 10%, we never borrowed at 3%. No friggin' way.
Right.
We were paying, you know, prime was 11 and we were paying a half over prime or something. We were paying 11.5. We never even got to walk in and say, we're lying about the inflation. It's really only 2, and us get a loan at 2, like these other guys have been able to do. Anyway, hold your thought on the other stuff. S&P futures up 92, NASDAQ futures up 427. We're going to go through this whole routine here in a minute. We'll take a
quick
break.
One of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices, along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Good luck with your layoffs, all right? I hope your firings go really well.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom. Greg Pappas on the board. We have Dan Janitas with us. S&P futures up 92. I guess, Dan, we're still quoting the SEPs are still on the board for a while, right, Greg? They go off today or next week?
Today.
Today. So the SEP and these are right together here, 90, up 92, 93. NASDAQ, the December, is up 432, so all of them are up a bunch. Dow is up 502. Now, we're higher in the SEP and S&P and NASDAQ we were yesterday. With the Dow, we were actually up over 500 and closed down 100. So we just running back that thing. Yesterday, Greg, I think the gold traded, the December gold contractor traded 26.30. It was down 62 points after 2 o'clock. Was it 62 bucks? And now it's back 16. So,
good for traders.
Yeah, it's good. Well, good for the ones that shorted, not the ones the guy who bought it from. Over in Asia, the Nikkei up 775. It's 2%, 37,155. Hang Seng up 352, over 18,000. 18,013. And even the Shanghai has got a kick in the butt here, up 18 points, 2736. We've just said, okay, we're off to the races here on just about everything. DAX up 323. That's 1.7%, over 19,000. FTSE up 92, 1.1%. CAC around up 154, 2%. So, not sure where the sell-off came from yesterday, but yesterday the Dow was down 103. Like I said, it was up over 500. S&P down 16, NASDAQ down 54. So we're up way more than we were down yesterday, not even close. Bonds up 6 basis points. These are 10 years. Dan and I are talking about 10 years going straight up since these guys are cutting the short-term rates. 3.75. The Bund up 1, 2.20. Japan up 3.86. Oil's up 62 cents, back up. Well, it's over 71 now, 71.53. Brent up 70 cents, 74.35. Natural gas down a penny, 226. RBOB up 2 cents, back over 2 bucks, 203. Gold up 17 bucks, 26.15. Like I said, I think it traded 26.36 yesterday. Then it went down to 25.70. It was a huge move down. Silver up 87 cents, 31.56. Again, how many times, Craig, did we say every time it goes over 30, you want to sell, just be careful when you do? If you did this time, you're a big loser. It's way 31.56. Copper up 7 cents, 437. We've got foreign exchange, euro 111, where it has been, pound 132, and the yen at 143. We've got Bitcoin up 2,700, no surprise there, 63,007. Yes, Greg, is all I can say. Yes.
Yes. Morning, everyone. 7:36 here in Chicago. It is 60 degrees now, high of 85 today, mostly sunny and warm. Same for Phoenix, 74 right now, high of 98, mostly sunny there. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose is 48 minutes, inbound Edens, yikes, 82 minutes from Lake Cook. Eisenhower from Wolf, 58 minutes. Ryan from 95th is 30 minutes, and the Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 51 minutes. MLB, the A's beat the Cubs. That was at Wrigley. That was 5-3. Arizona beat Colorado, 9-4. And the White Sox lost, surprised, and that was 3-4 in L.A. Pats at Jets tonight, and that's all I got. Back to you guys.
So the Cubs faded in September last year. They fell just short. Could not get the hits when they needed them. Pretty good pitching. This year the pitching's better. They have a better team. But they went out and got a manager and paid him a fortune. And guess what? They still can't hit in September. Same thing. Just saying, Greg. Right? You know, sometimes it's the X's and the O's and not the manager. Just saying. Dan, my shot at the Cubs here. But, kind of go into what you were mentioning. Does this long-term rate up again? Is that concerning to you?
You were asked the question again about why we saw a sell-off yesterday. I think the first thing, as I mentioned, that people were surprised as much as I was. Also, the concern that too many cuts are going to lead us back into the inflationary period. So there's they're talking 50 plus another 50 this year. So that's that's a one full percentage point cut in short rates. What that does is it does help companies' cost of capital. It does help companies, it's good for growth for companies when they're able to refinance at a lower rate, or they're able to keep their cost of capital down. So that there is a concern about, this becoming inflationary. However, I think investors now are looking at the positives of the cut being the positive impact on cost of capital. So they're looking at it from a different point of view. The way that we need to look at this now from a fixed income person's point of view, from a bond person's point of view, is that, short rates will continue to come down. So do not think about selling just because rates are a little bit lower. You're going to continue to make money in the short end of the yield curve, meaning, anything out to 2 years is going to be attractive going forward. What this is going to do in terms of shifting your money into bonds, and what we're planning to do, and we already started doing, we're going to start buying more corporate bonds because the spread, the difference, or the advantage, or the additional yield you get over treasuries is going to expand. And so they're going to look, corporate bonds are going to look more attractive than municipals. We do our homework in all the companies we invest in. We're seeing some good opportunities just starting to come there, and we don't see any major downturn in the economy, so we're looking even at high yield bonds. Municipals, which I've been screaming buy all year, I say continue to be a good buy. Again, stay on the short end of the curve, meaning short-term municipal bonds. There's a lot of, you're picking up a huge yield advantage. They're very attractive right now. They're going to continue to be attractive as short rates come down. It's also good for helping not only companies' cost of capital, but municipalities' cost of capital. So any projects that are being done, they're being financed through municipal debt. It's all going to be very positive for those organizations and those municipalities that are funding. So there's a lot of good news, and that's why we're seeing the futures rally today. One thing to pay attention to are what we refer to as credit spreads. Credit spreads are the difference between the yield on credit or a corporate bond and the yield on a treasury of the same maturity. As spreads widen, that's good news, and there's going to be a period of time here where we're going to be able to take advantage of it from an investor's point of view. They continue to widen, that's usually not good news. That would mean that we're looking at a higher chance of default and all that. It's still very early in the game. There's still no concern about defaults increasing. So I would say that there is that is what we want to be looking at going forward if the credit spreads start widening or that disparity between treasuries and corporates starts becoming larger, and that could be a concern. When you mentioned gold and silver, the reason that we're seeing an increase in silver and gold today, the dollar is dropping, and the dollar is dropping because of the cut in rates. And the Bank of England today, for example, kept rates unchanged, yet they're seeing probably less economic growth right now than we are. So I think they were the smart ones in this move. With the dollar coming down, that's good news for, generally good news for commodities, but particularly for gold and silver. So we have been invested in silver for a while. We're going to continue to ride it up. Other opportunities, I think, are going to be in we're starting to take a closer look at.
Dan, do you guys use the future silver, to use the SLV, or do you have a silver companies you like?
We generally do the SLV just because it's easy to get in and out of.
Yeah, we do too. That's our big spot.
Yeah, and it generally tracks. I have some clients that actually have physical, and it's a different market when you're talking about physical. But the SLV is really the way to trade it. It's very liquid, you know, and you can. It generally will track the price of silver, so that's really the way to gain access.
Well, allegedly,
one other area.
Well, real quick, allegedly, I haven't said it in a while, but I'm very wary of any of the ETFs that don't have the physical. That's why we always stick. Well, not always, but we stick with the big ETFs, the Spider, the Russell, and on the little spiders. My
right.
brother's got people in huge positions in the XLV, which is the healthcare piece. By the way, that's been a real nice winner this year.
That's an industry that kind of lagged that I think is coming back.
There's like 20 little spiders that add up to the big spider, like the XLEs, the oil piece. Quick question, just in execution, Dan. You say you want to talk about corporates, but you want to stay short. So you're not... I don't know how, well, I'll ask the question. Most corporates go out for, what, 10, 15, 20 years usually, and not all the time.
Yeah, but as time goes on, though,
yeah,
we,
I'm
trade,
saying so,
we only trade in the secondary market.
I know, so you're going to buy a corporate with 2 to 3 or 2.5 or 1.5, depending on which one you like, that's
right.
got that much left on the bond. So you're buying it from a seller. Who's necessarily the sellers? Are they individuals? Are they insurance companies that just want to roll out? Or Who sells the things?
We trade on an institutional platform, so they're generally institutions who are selling, and they're generally selling in larger blocks.
Why are they selling? I mean, if you like them, why don't they? I guess is the question.
There are a host of different reasons, you know. And this is having been a bond manager my whole career, understanding the way the trading happens. There are some people who feel that rates are too low, that spreads have narrowed a lot, that you're not picking up enough. Yield advantage over treasuries. So that has been one reason. But you're right, lately and even in just the last few weeks, corporates have become very attractive. There have been a few deals, new deals that have come, you know, where some companies have issued corporate debt recently as a way of financing, and those have been oversubscribed. So there's a lot of demand right now for corporates. Who the sellers are would just be, in some cases, it would be an insurance company.
What kind of rates in duration have those ones that have been oversubscribed? They're probably all different, but
they have different series basically, so they could have some fives and some tens. Generally, I think the ones that have come out recently are tens. I would not be buying 10-year corporates in here, but there's a demand because there is yield still, and I think the concern about as treasury rates come down, there's going to be less yield.
What is a
not my advice.
I'm not saying a triple A, but a nice A, or sometimes you guys get the high Bs. What is a five-year, say, high B going for now?
You can probably get 150, 100, you know, 150, like 1.5% more than the Treasury. So, we've been buying stuff, you know, paper like that at 5.5 to 6%, and then even some that it's closer to 7 if you're going to be willing to go down in credit quality. But this is where we do our homework, and we look at the companies, and we look at their free cash flow, and we look at the ability to pay down debt. They may not be exciting companies, but they're able to make their interest payments and then make their final principal payment. Default risk is the biggest risk when you go to lower quality bonds. And this is my expertise since day one in the business. Right now, default risk is extremely low for a couple of reasons. One is that we're just not in that environment economically. But the other reason is that there's a understanding that these companies are going to be bailed out, whether they're by the banks or they're able to do other financing. We have private equity companies stepping into some of these lower. There are so many people on the edge that can't wait for some distressed names to start purchasing them. And those people are the hedge funds, the private equity managers. They're looking for yield, they're looking for opportunity. And for so long, we haven't had opportunity in the distress space. In those companies that have issued bonds that are having financial difficulties for one reason or another. And that's, so there, I'm not concerned about default rates picking up. There are definitely gonna be buyers as if some of these names sell off. They're already circling and waiting for that to happen, but it's way too soon.
Well, Dan,
in the meantime, you invest in the better quality, you invest in the triple B, double B, single B, not single B, double B, triple B, single A, and you're getting 100, you're getting maybe 200, 2% more than you would in treasuries.
Right, so if the dude yesterday, I mean, we think he might be right someday, but he's like most people, it maybe, you know, he's probably early, but so if you tomorrow go out with, you know, one of the clients that we both have, some of them, if you go out tomorrow and buy, you put $100,000 in a 5 year, at 5.5, 5.75, something that looks good, and this guy's right. You know, 3 weeks from now the inflation perks up. It's obvious to everybody. Even Powell, he started it up again, and all of a sudden the 10 year comes flying in at some auction at, you know, 0.5 higher at like 5.5. I'm not saying this is going to happen, but if it did. How somebody's going to essentially be sucking on the price of that bond for a little while, but not horrible. It's just 5 years, but not horrible. Horrible.
More 2 year, 1 year, and 2 years.
Yeah, I'm saying the 2 year is why it was where you want to be. But you did mention. I'm just
two
in general.
Under.
No, I'm saying in general. We were talking about firms are coming out with 5 years. How bad would you take the hit on that 5 year for a couple of years? Would it trade like 90 or something?
I wouldn't be buying it, but you'd be buying it for, you want to have a high coupon.
Yeah.
So if it's, you want 5% or more for a coupon, you don't want to be buying a lower coupon that happens to be trading at a discount. I would say buy the higher coupon for the yield, but I would not be buying the five year. I'd be buying 1 year, 2 year. At the very longest would be 2 year. Looking for a duration of one. In the short, there is a fair amount of short-term paper. It's yielding more because short-term rates are still higher. So we've been buying some bonds at 6.5% that are money good, which means they'll be paid off, and they're not going to be impacted by changes in interest rates as much as a 5 year or 10 year would.
I think even if you go out five, your risk is obviously not like in 10, but there's still some risk there.
And 5 years, yeah, and that's why I'm suggesting to stay away from that right now. You're getting more yield on the shorter end still, despite the 50 basis point cut yesterday. You're still getting more yield. And the price of those bonds the corporate bonds has gone up a little, but not that much. So there's still some opportunities one example, and I know this is one that you're going to probably question me on, but Xerox has some bonds that mature in less than a year that are yielding 6.5%. Those bonds will be paid. And you're getting 6.5%, you're getting a 5 and a fraction coupon for less than a year, and that's pretty attractive for what I know is a money good bond. So that's just one example of you know, staying short. And you also can predict. I always had this argument with my mentor in the business. You can always predict. You can more easily predict a shorter term bond, the history of what's going to happen out a year, whether they have the cash to pay that when the bonds come due. But it's a little trickier when you buy in 5, 10, 30-year bonds. Some of those organizations may not be around if you're buying corporate debt. On the municipal side, it's the same thing. We tend to still favor very short-term. You're getting paid more, but you could go a little bit longer with your municipal bond. Again, be careful with going out much longer than 2 years right now because of exactly what you're saying, Chief. There's definitely a risk of higher rates. I don't know when that happens. It's probably going to start happening gradually. We're going to start seeing impact from this rate cut, and if there's a second one, which there probably will be before the end of the year, we'll definitely start seeing an impact next year. Some of it will also depend on the administration that comes in. I think if Harris comes in, there's less inflation likely. But if Trump gets in, I do think we'll see runaway inflation, and I do think we'll see much higher rates.
Neither of them seem to have a clue as how inflation gets here.
It's not their expertise. It really isn't. You know, I think Trump would like to think it is, but it really isn't their expertise. Hopefully, I think with Harris, she'll leave our industry alone. I think there's not going to be as much, you know, micromanaging of the of our markets, and I think that worked well during. Definitely during Obama's second
Dan,
term.
Dan, either one of us could give either one of them a 40-minute class, and they'd understand what the hell we're talking about. They just
absolutely.
Don't want it.
I think every human being, I think every person should have at least a 40-minute class. I think there's a lot of misconceptions, especially today, where there a lot of people get their information from YouTube. You know, there's a lot of different opinions in our industry, and I think not, you know, really having an expert. You know, educating yourself on the basics, you know, finance one-on-one, investment management one-on-one, trading one-on-one. And it only, it's like anything, more experience you have, the better you'll be at making decisions.
Well, how much flexibility, let's say, I guess it's, well, their supporters surely are, let's say the two candidates are as far apart as their supporters are. Let's hope not. But, does it really matter? The numbers right now are creating. What was the line in William Kennedy's book regarding dropping the atom bomb after they spent 2 years and how many 100,000 people were working on it and everything? His line was something like, "The events were in the saddle and they drove the men hard." Can anybody look at the debt clock? Either one of these two
yeah.
people on January or whatever, they have to see the same thing. It almost doesn't matter what you're, whether you're left, right, or green or whatever. I mean, the numbers, something, Trump can't look at that and say, we need another tax cut. She can't look at it and say, gee, we need another spending bill because with Wi-Fi everywhere, we're going to get more taxes in. Neither one of them can do that again here, I don't think, but can they?
No, you make a really good point that that's really been a huge back burner issue, and that really should be an issue in the forefront, I believe, because it's one of the biggest concerns is the enormous deficit right now and the enormous amount of debt that our country is carrying. And there should be a plan on how to deal with that, and it just seems to be glossed over. It's glossed over certainly even in the financial news networks that have been providing information. It's something that comes up every once in a while as something people don't want to deal with. It's like when you're doing your taxes, something that you always put off that you just, you know, it's not fun to do or deal with. But in this case, whoever gets in office is going to have to deal with it. There won't be a choice.
Well, Dan, I have to deal with it. I read this in a bunch of places. It has to be 5, 10, 15 years ago. It has to do with essentially the new economics. And the theory of it, I don't know that necessarily... you know, you could say the theory of I should go on a diet. If, by the way, I'm going out to have a pizza tonight. I mean, it's sort of the same thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But the new economics is okay. We've got this quote debt. It's whatever it is. It's 100% of the GDP. It's over that now. We're never going to pay it back. It's a question of maintenance. Now, if over the next 5 years, if we can grow the debt 10% and we grow the economy 10.1, we're gaining on it. And over the long haul, as long as we grow faster than the debt, we're going to be okay. So you see, every time in the last, even with the last two presidencies, you go further back, but the last two, when Trump came out with his tax cut, very meticulously and very forthrightly and very false witness part, they went to great lengths to say this tax cut is actually going to be accretive. That in 5 years it's going to cause these people that are paying less to make all this investments that they couldn't afford otherwise if they're sending us the money. And oh, by the way, in 5 years we're actually going to be growing 3% more, and even though this is going to put us in debt in the meantime, we're going to be ahead of it. And if you extend the thing out 20 years, we're positive. And when this gentlemen threw in the infrastructure plan and all the other stuff, they did the same thing. I mean, you know, I guess with all the diatribe, you don't hear it. They did the same thing. you guys don't understand. If we fix this bridge and people spend 2 minutes getting across it versus 25 now, all this stuff is going to be so accretive to the economy. And, oh, by the way, every neighbor is going to have Wi-Fi. Every neighbor is going to have five bars. Everybody's going to be so efficient that 5 years from now, this is actually a bargain. It's like putting up the Golden Gate Bridge. Not only do we build a bridge, we open up a whole area. Well, the fact is, they either lie to us or they're idiots, because both of them didn't do any. That's why we're in this kind of trouble. Trump's tax thing didn't make everybody so efficient that all they want to do is give more money to the government. And same thing with this other thing. But their mentality is, if I can make something to give us grow faster, even if it costs, it's an investment. It's not taxes. It's not giving money to my buddies, even though it really is. The mentality is, we're helping you people. And the fact is, they're giving money to people. And I don't know how we stop that. Am I totally wrong in what I'm saying here or not?
No, I mean, ask anybody who's lived in Boston during the Big Dig, when they expanded the airport and all the roads around the airport. Was that accretive? I don't know. I don't know. Every time I go back, I'm still sitting in traffic. So it's I think the planning of it is what's an issue. I think the ideas make sense. You know, big picture ideas make a lot of sense, and people think about the short term impact. But if you do think about longer term, it's a challenge. And I think we have to learn from history and kind of move forward with at least, you know, understanding the knowledge of what's happened in the
past. But are they, I guess, you know, this is the question that, you know, I think I'm starting to get pretty grumpy and suspicious about it. But my brother, you met Dan, and Dan, a brilliant guy. There wouldn't be a PTI without him. He does a terrific job for everybody. But he's still in the camp that these people, whoever they are, even Trump, do stuff that they honestly believe they're doing the right thing. And once in a while, you know, it just doesn't work out the way it works out. But my suspicions that really it's been planned from the beginning, I'm just becoming a grumpy old dude. And I don't know, Dan. I see it happen in the same way, and now when it's getting to the point where I can predict what happens, I'm not smarter than they are. They must know what I'm thinking. They must know what you're thinking. They must know this isn't going to work and do it anyway. I don't know why I'm going over to that side, but I am. And I know it, he and I disagree on this, but he's like, what else can Paul do? I said, what are you talking about, Dan? He's the one who created the crap. You know, it's one of those things. I mean, of course, brothers just argue no matter what. But am I getting too grumpy on this? I mean, they're abandoning the fight against inflation, essentially. They're abandoning the fight against the price level that they created. They're not going to fight that at all. Now, just tell us that. Okay?
Yeah. I agree with you on that point. Absolutely. There's the price, you know, the price level is still very high, and cutting by 50 basis points and talking about another 50 isn't going to help. No question about it. The numbers, we've talked about this before, the numbers are, they're always in, they're in arrears, they come later. And the impact of these cuts will come later, so we'll know next year what impact, you know, we'll start seeing some of the impact, but it generally takes, you know, 9 to 18 months before you see the biggest part of the impact. We'll see some short-term impact, but again, that's the way I look at it, is that some of these policies that were put in place, there was the focus, even though they talk about it being long-term, really it was more short-term focused in terms of the benefit it could have in the short run, or at least the benefit, the excitement it'll have in the markets, for example.
Dan, I wouldn't.
I don't know if we have a minute.
Yeah, we'll go a minute over. But just one thing. Don't wait the 6 months this time, because it'll be 6 months in a row they've raised the money supply. They've already been doing this.
I absolutely agree, and that's the way. That's why we're invested relatively conservatively in this environment, and you know, we're focused on where the yield is, and we're focused on where the opportunities are. One quick idea that I've been at this conference for small cap companies, we're starting to step back in as rates are coming down. We're looking for areas of opportunity. We do think small caps still have some upside. One company that I think you'll appreciate, Chief, they're Daktronix. They're the company that makes the displays at sports arenas, stadiums.
Oh, really? Wow.
And they have 60% market share.
The displays are the TVs or both?
I'm sorry?
The displays or the TVs?
The displays.
Okay.
And they also have the technology, you know, they have a proprietary technology for the displays. And as you know, if you've been to any sports stadium, there's been a huge expansion in the displays, you know, especially the newer stadiums. So they're a strong cash flow business, extremely well run. The CEO and the CFO are fantastic. South Dakota-based company, their stock had run like many companies, but it's sold off recently in the last 3 months.
What's the symbol?
It's trading around 12. What's the symbol? Bucks. I think it's a buy-in here.
What's the symbol?
I think DAKT.
DAKT.
DAKT. And the people know the company because they have market share in the displays, the electronic displays that you see. But they also do other, they have other sides of the business. The military is a big part of their business. Transportation, when you see the signs and the displays as you're driving on a highway. Their businesses are well-rounded. But what I like about them as a company is the focus on cash flow. They're actually, in terms of technology, they're state-of-the-art. Market share they have. Their biggest competition are a few companies in China, and I think as we move more towards a Made in America scenario, that's going to benefit them. They still have, you know, some exposure with some of the parts they get to China, but overall, I would say this is a buy if you're looking for a unique opportunity outside of the big seven tech names.
Dan, if you go down the highway and you see not just the old kind of signs, but the big, huge honking ones now that they can change the message on them like every 30 seconds or whatever. Is that these guys?
Yes, that's these guys.
Wow.
Absolutely.
You see those things going up all over the place.
You go to Wrigley Park, you go to any of the, any sports stadiums, and the chances are very high that it's their not only their displays, but also their technology.
Wow. Well, Dan, thank you very much. Good talking to you as usual. SP Futures still up 86, down from the 94, but still pretty freaking high. NASDAQ up 413. Again, we sold off yesterday. I don't know, Dan. I don't know if we are going to sell off today. What do you think?
I had a view that it was going to be relatively flat. That we're going to see a little bit of a rally just because people are seeing that we'll see the benefits. But hard to know. You know, that's.
We'll talk at you, buddy. Have a good weekend, and talk at you next too. Week. Again, we'll be back tomorrow. Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.